This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Have you used an Airbnb rental on your vacation travels? Does your company instruct employees to check out whether Airbnb is a better deal than a downtown hotel? You may think Airbnbs are only important in big tourist markets like New York or New Orleans, San Francisco, but it is also a real and growing force here in Cincinnati. To talk about the short-term rental market, Airbnbs and other companies similar to them, and a proposal currently in the Cincinnati City Council to regulate them, I am joined by an Airbnb operator, Chris Heichel. Chris also is working with and is a spokesperson with Short-Term Rentals of Cincinnati, which is a group of about 60 to 65 Airbnb owners who are in the process of organizing. Also, Cincinnati City Council member David Mann, and Over the Rhine resident and a member of the Coalition for Sensible Short-Term Rental Policy, Margie Waller. To join the discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody, to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Chris, let's start out. Just give us a sense. How big is the local short-term? And I'm going to use Airbnb as just a shorthand for all of this because people are – but there's HomeAway, there's VRBO, there's lots of other companies out there. But for the Airbnb market, how big is this in Cincinnati?
One of my favorite ways of looking at the size of the short-term rental market in Cincinnati is the number of guests that we bring to town. In 2017, we estimate that we brought 42,000 guests to Cincinnati. 2018 is looking like, we don't have the full numbers yet, but it's looking like about 40% more than that. In terms of revenue to
40%, so what you're indicating is rapid growth.
Mm-hmm. It would be rapid but potentially slowing. So last year was closer to 50%. The year before that was 60%. So continuing to be rapid growth but decelerating pace. In terms of revenue to homeowners, I believe it was about $5 million in aggregate. And then you could also look at it in terms of commercial and consumer impact, which we can talk about.
Okay. Marty Waller, you live in Over the Rhine, and this is one of the areas that has a significant number of the short-term rental units in operation. How does this impact you, and can you visibly recognize the growth that Chris was just talking about?
Thanks, Dan. Yes, what brought me to this conversation was noticing it in my own neighborhood of Over the Rhine in the blocks right around me and observing units that clearly had become full-time year-round, basically hotel rooms. Chris mentioned that he likes to think of it in terms of number of visitors. Of course, we don't know whether those visitors might have stayed in hotels if they hadn't come. What I think of it in terms of is loss of neighbors. So all of those units, which are not really homeowners, most of these units are owned by investors and nobody lives in them full-time ever. They're just hotel rooms for transient visitors. There are places where neighbors could be living, where people could be voting for our leaders, could be joining our community council, could be coming to our street parties. They could be just investing in the neighborhood and what kind of place we live in. But instead, we have empty properties where nobody lives, and the people who come in and out don't have any reason to or even way of becoming involved in the future of our neighborhood.
I mean, can you sense this, though, in any sort of observable way in your immediate part of Over the Rhine?
Sure. I should have said one thing I did when after David Mann introduced the legislation, I actually sat down and studied the Airbnb website to see if I could quantify it. And it's hard to do because they don't usually list their actual addresses. So you have to know your neighborhood well and know where some of these properties might be. What I discovered after kind of a deep dive into it was there are at least within a half a block of my house, 15 full-time year-round hotel room units. So those are 15 places where people could be living, I could have neighbors, people could be renting, could be participating in our community.
Okay. Chris, there is a distinction here between units that are, as Margie is calling, are calling out that they are full-time short-term rentals. Nobody lives there. And there are also places where people, the owners live, and they rent out a room or a section of their house. Well, how does that get divided up here?
In terms of overall impact to the local economy, the vast majority of guests and the vast majority of revenue come through unhosted short-term rentals. Unhosted, as you said, means that the owner of the building actually does not live there. They may live nearby or they may live next door in a duplex, for example, but they're not actually inside of the dwelling unit. That's also where we're seeing most of the growth in the short-term rental economy.
Okay. So these unhosted units are a big part of this. They're not just some of the market, which actually I found surprising. I didn't know that. I wasn't clear on that. David Mann, what got you concerned about this? I mean, to pass legislation, I mean, we've just sort of been describing what the situation. Margie has talked a little bit about impact on neighborhood as community. But what got you involved in this?
Well, Dan, the first thing that early this year that got my attention were some anecdotal reports about properties in OTR being shorn of residents. Tenants were being evicted, and the indications were that the property owner's purpose in doing that was to convert the units to full-time short-term rentals, full-time in the sense that, as you say, we're not talking about renting a room. We're talking about renting the whole unit. And we know we have an affordable housing shortage in this community of about 40,000 for the county. And it seems to me that if rental unit numbers go down because of an increase in the use of those units in the short-term rental market, if supply and demand means anything, there's less of supply, therefore increasing demand on what's left, therefore rent levels go up. And there are studies from around the country indicate that in many communities, that's exactly what's happening. There's a correlation, zip code by zip code, census tract by census tract, between housing units being converted to the Airbnb world and taken out of the rental market and increases in rent rates. That's not good. And then as I got into it, Margie came forward with her information, and to think that there are 14 units within a half block of where she lives that don't have full-time neighbors, her neighborhood is being transformed in a way that I think over time is not good. So that led me to say, what's happening here, and do we care about this? And I think we should, and that's why I put forward some legislation. There was a pushback from Chris and some others about some of the details. I spent a few months revising and came forward with another approach, which still is opposed because I want to put some sort of cap on the growth in these so-called unhosted units, and that's where we are now.
And we'll get to the specifics of the proposal in just a minute. Chris, where geographically, how are Airbnb units, especially the unhosted ones, how do they spread not only through the city but regionally?
I can speak much more to the city than I can regionally. Okay. Within the city, the neighborhoods with the highest density of short-term rentals are over the Rhine, East Walnut Hills, and Northside and Clifton. Over the Rhine, for example, has, we would estimate, about 90 unhosted full-time short-term rentals. Now, when we say 90, if you were to go to, say, airdna.com and start looking for the data, it says 195. But then once you filter down to the ones that actually are truly full-time, meaning the owner never lives there, you're down to about 90 of them. So you take a look at – I mean, our group is extremely sympathetic to a lot of the things that Councilmember Mann is looking at and a lot of the things that Margie are looking at. But what we really ask for and what we think is important is to have a data-oriented approach to policy, right? So when we say things like evictions may be happening due to short-term rentals or existing housing stock may be being taken by short-term rentals, What we look at is, what are the actual numbers behind that, and how should that correlate with policy? And the main thing that we've seen is that there's just very little evidence, if any, to support the notion that there's a relationship between affordable housing and short-term rentals in Cincinnati. And specifically, most of the data that does exist suggests that there is no relationship at all. And so that's the key thing, is we say, this is a bit of a red herring right now. And if you were to kill short-term rentals and stop them from growing entirely, or kill all of the ones that are there right now, for example, it really would not do anything to help the affordable housing situation.
David Mann, you were talking about the relationship of this to affordable housing. What about just other practical issues? So, for example, there have been reports of that there were, in certain neighborhoods, there were problems with people coming in using these as party houses.
Sure, right.
Because they're going to leave in, you know, 2 days or whatever, and there's a noise issue, there's a nuisance issue. These are more short-term than what we're talking about, and we'll come back to all of that. But how much are those sorts of short-term issues?
Well, there have been some, some of those venues are actually being marketed as weekend party houses. And for the weekend, at least, behavior is not what you would like to see next door to your house. And maybe the density in terms of the number of people that are there violates all sorts of rules that otherwise apply. One of the things we have to keep in mind here, it's a little separately from your question, we're talking about the potential to generate a lot of revenue. So I'm expecting that this trend is going to continue. The top revenue producer in OTR has 2 units, and per year, according to publicly available data, is generating revenues of $120,000. Now, that's 2 units, and you figure out what the monthly rent would be to match that. So why wouldn't – I mean, naturally, people are going to move in that direction, and we have to ask, what does that do to neighborhoods? What does that do to the housing supply? And at a minimum, and this is something that needs to be looked at more, as I'm understanding, we need to make sure that where these are permitted matches the zoning rules about what kind of structures and what kind of use of structures there is.
Okay. A quick question before we have to take a break, and I'm not sure who the right person to answer this is. But with hotels, if these are in effect substitute for hotel rooms, with hotels, the county is receiving significant dollars, taxable dollars, that goes into a variety of things, Convention and Visitors Bureau, the convention center, et cetera, in terms to fund those. If we are, in effect, creating lots of little hotels, what happens to that money? Are these Airbnb charging the hotel room rent that a hotel would have to?
So I can take that one. So there's a few things there, but I think one thing that's important to clarify as I introduce this concept is that our group is not an anti-regulation group, and we're not an anti-tax group. So we think smart regulations and smart taxes are okay. In fact, our group proposed a 7% tax on short-term rental revenue that would go towards the Affordable Housing Trust. So we're fine with the notion of a tax. But to be completely clear, if you look at the city, county, or state definition of a hotel, short-term rentals do not fit that criteria. So we're not hotels, and we have no desire to be classified as hotels. We are rental units where people stay often for less than 30 days, and there is an existing definition for that. So we don't need to go reclassifying things.
Okay. We have to take a break. After the break, all three of my guests will return. We'll take a look at David Mann's the specifics of David Mann's proposals and some of the reactions to those. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Should the city of Cincinnati bring some standards to the local Airbnb market? To discuss that proposal and the concrete proposal that has been put forward, we are joined by Airbnb operator Chris Heichel, the Cincinnati City Council member, David Mann, and Over the Rhine resident and member of the Coalition for Sensible Short-Term Rental Policy, Margie Waller. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. I want to get a caller in who has been on the line and make sure we get get her in initially. Layla, you have a question or an observation?
Yeah, there was, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there was comments about losing neighbors and that these rentals that maybe the whole unit is being rented out would be something that is used year-round, where my personal experience when I lived in Over the Rhine a few years ago with the rental rates going up, it was a way to capitalize on time that we didn't spend at our apartment and make it affordable to be neighbors and part of the community, which was increasingly hard to afford to live there. So we used it to rent out on weekends or vacations away. So it wasn't like we were hosts that stayed in the unit and rented out a room. We did give them the whole space, but there's kind of that missing portion of users, I think.
David, would that clarify, is that a unhosted or a hosted unit?
That is an unhosted unit.
Okay.
Because when you're renting it, you're not there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
I would say our coalition does not object to that. To me, those are my neighbors, and they are there most of the time. We don't object to the situation where people rent it out on weekends occasionally when they're away or if they're gone for a week in the summer.
Well, so I want to unpack that a little bit because I've never really understood this argument about losing neighbors, right? So if we take Over the Rhine, for example, which has a population that's exploded over the last few years, right? Take Margie as an example. Margie has far more neighbors than she ever had. If you take the Elm Street, right, between Liberty Street and 14th, which is where Margie is, that's where Magnolia connects, there were 18 vacant buildings, right, 4 years ago on that street, and there were 8 vacant lots. And now there are 2 vacant buildings and 1 vacant lot, right? And it just doesn't – none of that really makes sense, but that's kind of the practical side of it, right? Just is it factually true? But outside of the factuality, I think we should look at it philosophically, right, which is – what is the actual grievance or thing that's being discussed here, right? What is the material harm that we're discussing? And when I think about this argument of kind of like, you know, I don't know my neighbors, they're not participating in my community council, I think we have to unpack it and say, okay, so are we talking about a nuisance issue? No, we haven't really heard about nuisance issues on this street. Are we talking about litter? No. Are we talking about homeowners who've done something to deface the property visually? No, in fact, they tend to do the opposite, make it much nicer for short-term rentals. And so then it comes down to, is there a security issue or a safety issue? No, we're not hearing about that. So if I were just looking at this as a neutral bystander.
Okay, so let's let Margie respond. What is the issue, Margie?
I moved into the Over the Rhine because I wanted to live in a diverse neighborhood where families live. That's what I moved into, with full expectation that, yes, the buildings around me would be renovated and I would have new additional neighbors. I did not expect to move into a place where hotels would pop up next door to me. And because this is an unregulated area up to now, that is what's happening. But at the time that I moved in, I and none of the other people in that area who invested and created our own space and loved the diversity and quietness of our part of the Over the Rhine had no reasonable expectation that our neighborhood would be commercialized in this way. And that is exactly what's happening. It fundamentally changes the character of our place, the quality of life that we have in our neighborhood, and we object to that.
David, give us a quick synopsis of the key points in your current proposal for legislation.
Basically, all Airbnb units, hosted and unhosted, would have to be registered. The unhosted would have to be licensed because there would be additional requirements to assure safety. There would have to be a certification by an architect or an engineer that all the building codes, fire provisions, and so forth were complied with. Because, frankly, when somebody is in and out of – some bodies are in and out of a unit, who knows whether it's safe in the sense we obviously significantly regulate hotels very differently because strangers to the community come in and stay there. And over and above that, there would be a 7% tax. And Chris is absolutely right. His group has indicated a willingness to support that. But essentially, I've tried two ways to cap what's happening. One is, which speaks to the earlier caller about wanting to rent her unit part of the year, it would have prohibited renting more than 90 days a year if it's an unhosted unit. And there was a lot of pushback on that. So the alternative is to limit how many units a single person or entity could operate and limit to three. And there's a lot of pushback on that, too, even though at the hearing we had recently, very few of those who spoke have more than three. But there's an interest, I guess, in increasing the numbers. And another aspect of this that has come up in recent weeks is that on the banks, there's a residential development that the city provided tax abatement for and also direct subsidy, which was supposed to be residential, the current. And the operator of the current came forward and said, oh, by the way, we're in a process of shifting 70 of our 300 units to the Airbnb market, not through Airbnb, but through something called Guildhouse. There have been some developers up around UC that have come forward expressing the same concern, their interest in the short-term rental market around Children's Hospital. I mean, there's a lot going on. And if you think that
– so if there's enough of that going on, this becomes a corporate entity, enterprise, not just a person in their home trying to supplement their income is the point.
Yeah. Thank you,
Chris, any quick point on that?
Absolutely. So our group we put together our own proposal back in June, and we thought that the best way to limit the growth on Airbnbs was through a per unit – maximum number of units in a single structure, right? So when we talk about, for example, a property at the banks having 70 units put into it, that concerns us as well, right? We think that that may be something we have to analyze, but we think what actually solves for that the best is our proposal, which had a per structure limit. One of the reasons why a per owner limit, capping it to three units per owner, is not a great idea, is because short-term rentals are one of the few businesses that are highly accessible to people without a lot of wealth, without a lot of savings, and who happen to be in minority and disenfranchised neighborhoods.
Okay. Because
specifically, I want to talk about mortgages, right? A mortgage it's a financial instrument that's really understandable and accessible to almost anybody as long as they have property. And so if we say we're going to put barriers to growing this business, the people who are most impacted by that are people who are currently basically economically disenfranchised. And so we view that as a concern on behalf of people in our group.
I want to get to some other calls, but David, very quickly, do you have an answer to that? Response?
Yeah, you know, it's
okay.
I mean,
well, let's go on. Let's go on.
I don't think it addresses the overall concern
Okay. I'd like to get Jeffrey. You have an observation question?
Hello?
Please go ahead.
Yeah. So my question is that one of the arguments that I hear from a lot of people who are resisting Airbnb regulations is that when it comes to codes and building codes and zoning codes and such, it puts an undue burden on their business. When these kinds of rules are for protecting the public and their guests, I want try to figure out why these are being resisted when every other kind of business has to follow these types of rules.
I can take that one. So
you get 15 seconds.
Okay. So we brought 42,000 guests to Cincinnati in 2017 without a single safety incident. The reason why hotels have different rules is because they hold thousands of people at once. If there's an issue, thousands of people need to get out at once.
Okay.
You have a single family home or a fourplex, very different situation.
I have to get out. I want to thank Margie Waller, Chris Heichel, and David Mann for joining us today. After the break, 2-year adventure into the heart of the United States along its great inland rivers.